Sometimes I feel like I sound a bit like Jiminy Glick when I'm hosting this show.
Oh, like, God. So much love for Jiminy Glick.
Jiminy Glick. Ebony, what's your freak out? Hello, and welcome to Feminist Frequency Radio. This is episode 55. Anita's on an away mission this week, so it's me, Carolyn Pettit, in the captain's chair, and I'm joined, as always, by my fellow Copacabana enforcer, Ebony Adams. Hey, Ebony.
Hey, Carol.
I was trying to decide if we work at the Copacabana on weekends to earn a little extra cash, or if I wanted to keep going with the Star Trek metaphor and say that we go to the holodeck in our spare time to live out our fantasy of being Copacabana enforcers. I couldn't decide, so I'll let the audience, the listeners, be the judge of that.
Given what we're going to be talking about today, I'm happy to be working the Copacabana coat room with you.
But we'll put it up to a Twitter poll, you know? Okay. When I was a kid, sometimes like the A-Team or Knight Rider or whatever would end with like, call, you know, this number if you want ending A or if you want ending B. Like, maybe we let listeners...
Yo, can you imagine if we did a Feminist Frequency Radio that was a choose-your-own-adventure?
Wow. I would love for us to do like some sort of radio drama, choose-your-own-adventure thing. I'm into it. All right, this is the show that asks you to be critical of the media you love, or alternatively, we are the feminist killjoys coming for your medias, depending on your perspective. This week, we're going on a road trip with Viggo Mortensen and Mahershala Ali with a new film, Green Book. And after that, we'll finish the show by each sharing a little something in What's Your Freak Out? Now, on with the show. God, I feel like I sound a bit like Jiminy Glick when I'm hosting this show.
Oh, like, God. So much love for Jiminy Glick.
Jiminy Glick. Ebony, what's your freak out?
If you do not know who Jiminy Glick is, please do yourself a favor and Google Jiminy Glick interviews Steven Spielberg, and you will shit yourself.
Some of his interviews are just tremendous. So, you know, first things first, before we actually get into the show proper this week, I need to actually issue an apology for something I said on last week's show. For those of you who listened to last week's show will recall, the main topic was the chilling adventures of Sabrina. And during our discussion of the show, we talked for a bit about the character of Susie, one of, you know, Sabrina's high school friends. And during the conversation about Susie, we spoke a bit about Susie's sort of gender identity, which is I think, sort of undefined by the show at this point, or maybe by the character of Susie themselves. They seem to be in a point of maybe potentially exploring it. Apparently, in one episode that maybe is later in the season that I didn't see, Susie maybe steals a copy of Orlando, the novel by Virginia Woolf, which is definitely a clear indication, you know, or a way for the show to kind of nod about the gender explorations that the character of Susie might be kind of going through. And at one point during the conversation, I made a distinction that I should not have made, a distinction that was incorrect, during which I said that Susie, you know, might be non-binary, but is not trans. And so what I did there was I created a sort of opposition between non-binary and trans, obviously, non-binary identities can be and are trans. Non-binary people can be and are trans people. So that was not something I should have said, and I sincerely apologize. Part of what, I mean, not by way of excuse at all, but just to kind of review the conversation a bit, I got confused and thrown off at one point during the conversation because I understood, or maybe misunderstood, Anita to be suggesting that Susie was a trans woman. That is, that Susie identified as a woman but had transitioned, you know, maybe was not assigned female at birth, but had transitioned and was, you know, was a young trans woman, and, you know, which I did not see to be the case. And so I was sort of trying to push back against that, but in doing so, I misspoke and I got, you know, my wires crossed, and I sincerely apologize for the error that I made. Of course, non-binary people can be and are trans people.
Yeah, I mean, you know, yeah, and no, again, no excuses. I think part of our confusion, because it did stem from confusion, is that neither you nor I have seen the entire season, first season of Chilling Adventures of Sabrina, and I doubt either one of us is going to. But I think, you know, at least from the 5 or 6 episodes I saw, the show itself is not clear. And I think this is one area you want to be clearer about what you're expressing. So again, not an excuse or a rationalization, but yeah.
Yes. You're right. You're right. I mean, I think it's a very valid and interesting character arc that they may be setting up, right? It's entirely possible that Susie, because apparently later in the season, a character uses male pronouns when referring to Susie, and Susie does not object to it. So it may be that, you know, it's pure speculation. It may be that Susie will come to identify explicitly as non-binary. It may be that Susie is a trans man. We don't know. There's obviously a lot of possibilities, a lot of places that can go. Anyway, so I'll be very interested to see where that show goes with that in the future. All right, Ebony, what do you got for us in entertainment news this week? The tables have turned.
Yeah, and people will recall that anytime the tables have been turned in the past and I've gotten to deliver pop culture news, it is terrible. Usually the news is bad, but also I rarely consider what other people might want to hear about or might want to discuss. This is all about things that I give a shit about. So here we go. Number one. Daredevil has been canceled after 3 seasons on Netflix. So it has joined Iron Fist and Luke Cage in cancellation. It's very interesting to me that of the Marvel slate that I assumed, because, you know, I exist only in my own tiny corner of the internet, that, you know, I assumed the entire Marvel slate was doing well. I constantly see people talking about it, tweeting about the shows, et cetera. But yeah, 3 of the 5 have been canceled. We can now assume then that there'll be no resumption of interest in the Defenders mashup series either. So what we have left is Jessica Jones.
Yeah.
And Punisher. And I find it very interesting.
Oh, God, Punisher. I totally forgot about Punisher.
I think a lot of people did. But I find it interesting that, so you had 5 shows, right? So you had Jessica Jones, Punisher, Iron Fist, Luke Cage, and Daredevil. Luke Cage, obviously, lead actor, black man. Daredevil, lead actor, white, disabled lead actor. You know, Iron Fist has obviously a white male lead, but my understanding, because that show looked terrible, was that Misty Knight and Colleen Wing, black woman and an Asian woman respectively, were vital parts of that cast, right? So I think it's very interesting that of the 2 shows that are remaining, they're both fairly straightforward in terms of their casting of straight white people, right? But I think also, you know, there's a business aspect to this, in that Disney, which owns these characters, is gearing up for a new streaming service of their own called Disney Plus. And the word is that they are going to be pulling Marvel movies to that. They will only be available on that Disney streaming service. So movies like, you know, The Avengers or Black Panther or whatever, any upcoming things. So I'm wondering how much of these recent cancellations has to do partially with that business decision. But I can't help but suspect that a lot of it is just that there is, you know, currently at whatever level, whether it's purely at the level of the audience or purely at the level of the decision makers, you know, really an inability to let some of these grow further and gain an audience if they don't have a white, straight, you know, abled, lead character. I don't know. It's very interesting. And I thought of all of them, I actually had thought that Daredevil was the most popular after Jessica Jones. Which may obviously still be the case, but it didn't, you know, reach whatever bar needed to be so that they could go into season 4.
Yeah, and it'll be interesting to see if you know, in as Jessica Jones continues, presumably we'll get at least 1 more season of Jessica Jones. If, you know, characters like Luke Cage or, you know, maybe some of the other characters whose shows have been canceled will continue to to sort of weave in and out and play supporting roles in that narrative, as these shows have had so many kind of little crossovers and things before, or if with their shows being canceled, they will largely be kind of, you know, written out of say, Jessica Jones as well.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and do you watch any of the Marvel shows on Netflix?
Only Jessica Jones.
Yeah, I watched Jessica Jones and enjoyed it. I really loved Daredevil. I think I spoke in an earlier episode about how I had just finished watching season 3. I loved Luke Cage. Iron Fist was never going to watch. I started watching Punisher and binged through, like, I don't know, I want to say 3 episodes, but it is hard going for reasons it might be useful or interesting to unpack in a later episode, because I do think this show was trying occasionally to comment upon, like, hyperviolence and hypermasculinity, but in a way that was so easily dismissible by a huge portion of its audience that you have really sort of, like, you know, many reactionary, toxic parts of its fandom, you know, essentially saying, like, yes, this show speaks to us. This is, like, they absolutely embrace the vigilanteism that the Punisher, you know, engages in, with no sense that there might be a critique underlying it, you know?
Exactly. Yeah. So, yeah. What else you got for us?
Oh, boy. Okay. So this is not pop culture news. This is simply culture news. And it's I give up news. Former President George H.W. Bush died a few days ago. And it amazes me whenever a historical figure like this dies, the way that people who are supposedly liberal or progressive outdo themselves to be seen as civil and politic by offering encomiums about people. Listen, George H.W. Bush, war criminal, okay?
I mean, 100%. You know? Unmitigated, yes. And, like, that should be the dominant, like, narrative about, you know, his legacy, his, you know, passing. And yet, is that what we're getting from the media? No.
No, I don't care about his service dog. I don't care about his family relationships. I don't care what his lap blankets look like. Yeah, you know.
Somebody, like, tell his dog what a monster his master was, so he doesn't, like, curl up sadly by the coffin anymore, man. That,
like,
man was,
you know,
not
what?
Worth
you
the love.
You don't
and
get
dedication.
To humanize a person like this who spent his entire life dehumanizing others and actively campaigning for the death and suppression of others. I mean, if you want to talk about one issue, it was recently World AIDS Day. If you want to talk about the devastation wreaked upon the LGBT community via, you know, people like Reagan and Bush, and then, you know, expect me to not give you my full-throated opinion of that person after they've passed, simply because they have done what every human being will always do, which is ultimately die. No. And you know what else? This whole notion that, like, don't speak ill of the dead, y'all can fuck right off with that. But also, like, if you feel as if you are unwilling, for whatever personal reasons, to speak ill of the dead, you can always choose to not say anything. You don't have to join in the chorus of people who are trying to humanize a monstrous figure like this. You can just say nothing. But that's clearly never, ever going to be the case. And so you get figures like Hillary Clinton and Barack Obama, you know, talking to us about what a devoted family man he was and how he was a true statesman, which blew my fucking mind. So I guess this is me campaigning for people to just say nothing.
Yeah, I think sometimes people who don't really understand what's at stake here will look at people sort of raising the reality of who a man like George H.W. Bush was and say, oh, you're just doing it to, like, dance on his grave. It's just about, like, glee at his death. And it's really not about that at all. Fundamentally, it's about trying to challenge what we know is almost certainly going to be the dominant historical narrative of, oh, he was a great statesman, he was a good, decent family man, he was a good president, etc., and, like, inject the truth in there of no, actually, what we should be focusing on is, you know, the people of Iraq who needlessly died because of his malicious actions, the gay people who needlessly died because of his negligence, you know, as president during, you know, the height of the AIDS crisis, et cetera, et cetera. Like, these things will be erased by history if people don't, refuse to be silent about them.
Absolutely. So, do I have time for one final piece of...
Squeeze in one last quick story for us, yeah.
Okay, so this is something that I've been very interested in. There's been this this discussion lately, a more prevalent discussion lately, about depending upon what Twitter circles you float around in, is alternately called either black fishing or nigger fishing. So this is the phenomenon whereby people who are white have been sort of donning, accessorizing with, you know, the cultural markers of a certain kind of blackness, specifically on Instagram, other forms of social media, but specifically Instagram. So I'm speaking specifically about people like white Swedish Instagram star Emma Hallberg, right, who is a white girl who has, you know, very fair skin in her earlier pictures and, you know, sort of straight but fairly nondescript brunette hair. But then, you know, as she becomes more famous, or in fact becomes famous for darkening her skin, not blackface, but, you know, heavily tanned, and then, you know, big gold earrings, the sort of like urban fashion that is, you know, most associated with black women. And this is rife on Instagram. And it is... these are the sorts of, you know, influencers in quotation marks, right, who are often celebrated because of their presumed proximity to blackness while not being black. If in fact they ever make it explicit that they are not black, right? There's only one form of blackness that they are interested in, right? And it's a very codified marketplace kind of blackness. But the whole point is they have entered a marketplace in which, you know, race and culture can be traded for esteem and for dollars because it has the trappings of a certain kind of blackness, but is not in fact black itself. So it is very, it's very safe to consume. I think it's very interesting that it's primarily young women who are engaging in this. I think it's very interesting, you know, so it's not just youth, but that it's women, right? We rarely see men doing this to any large extent, but I'm blown away by this. So you can check this out. You can check out the hashtag. There's an article on Slate about it. We'll put the link up there. But
yeah.
I don't spend a lot of time on Instagram, but even I recognize, and I have seen these pictures of people who I assumed were, you know, biracial or who were very light complexion black women. But it turns out they are white. And when you ask them, what is it about, you know, like, what are you trying to do? What is this? Their answers are really slippery, and they will, you know, swear up and down that they are not accessorizing with blackness. And yet and still, it's clear that that's exactly what they're doing. And audiences are eating it up. I mean, we're talking about people who have hundreds of thousands, if not more, of followers who absolutely love what they're doing. But as I say, it's about proximity to blackness. It's about, you know, a perceived distance from whiteness, but in a safe zone, a sort of liminal zone, whereby you get the cool factor, but you have none of the other associations or challenges associated with actually living with that racial identity. As the great Paul Mooney once said, everybody want to be a nigga, but nobody want to be a nigga. So that's it for pop culture news from your pal Ebony.
Did you know that we can keep bringing Feminist Frequency Radio to the airwaves because of you? It's true. If you're enjoying our show, please consider joining our podcast community at d.rip/femfreak. You'll get access to some fun perks and bonus episodes. So that's d.rip/femfreak.
And interestingly, that last pop culture news story, I think, serves as a pretty interesting lead-in to our main topic of conversation today, which is the new film Green Book, because in the film, there are actually kind of explicit conversations, you could say, about, like, what it means to be, in a sense, you know, quote-unquote, really black,
yeah.
Right? So Green Book is a new drama starring Viggo Mortensen and Mahershala Ali. I like that they were committed to getting two lead actors who both have names that are kind of difficult to pronounce. This movie is directed by of all people, Peter Farrelly, who with his brother Bobby Farrelly was responsible famously for films including, you know, There's Something About Mary, Dumb and Dumber, Kingpin, those sort of really broad, raunchy comedies. This film is actually, it's a drama. It has sort of Oscar bait kind of written all over it. Green Book, the film, is set in the early 1960s, and the title of Green Book refers to a series of publications by a man named Victor Green. The publications were called the Negro Motorist Green Book. They were published from 1936 to 1966, and they were intended to provide Black people who were traveling in the United States with information about where they could stay, where they could eat, and so on, in, you know, the hopes that they might minimize their risk of running into and encountering, well, certainly establishments where they were explicitly unwelcome, or and, of course, violence, though there's no way to travel throughout the United States, you know, as a Black person then or now without the risk of violence. But the books were intended as guides to sort of minimize that or mitigate that. But the film, you know, despite being called Green Book, it isn't really about the Green Books at all. They're sort of just a minor prop in the story. The film is about, it is as the posters tout, it is, quote, based on a true friendship. So the film is about Italian tough guy, Tony Vallelonga, which I'm probably saying wrong. And in fact, the movie makes some jokes about how his name is kind of tough to pronounce. He's referred to, widely as Tony Lip because he was the best bullshitter in Brooklyn or the Bronx or whatever among a circle of friends when he was a kid. Tony Lip, he takes a job driving the brilliant jazz pianist Don Shirley, who is a Black man. And his trio, the Don Shirley Trio, you know, on a tour of the Deep South. Interestingly, the National Board of Review just named Green Book the best film of 2018, and named Viggo Mortensen best actor. So let me start by saying that, look, you know, if I had seen, this is exactly the kind of film that if I'd seen it when I was, say, 15, you know, like a well-meaning young white kid who had no real media literacy, you know, awareness, and certainly wasn't privy to conversations or about representation and so on. Like, I would have thought this was like a good movie. I would have thought, hey, you know, it's a good movie. It's, you know, it's clearly like anti-racism. It's, you know, whatever. It's a heartwarming story of like a white man and a Black man who become friends, et cetera, et cetera. Like, and I really think that even today, the white critical sort of establishment would have largely like accepted and praised this film. It's only in my mind because, you know, thanks to social media and, you know, websites that and outlets where more writers of color, you know, have a voice and can raise issues about these things that really were able now to see a pushback against this film and see the important issues about it raised. Because, you know, I think that it is so much the generic sort of Oscar prestige picture that seems to I'd say most white viewers, not, you know, innocuous, but even kind of pleasant and even kind of positive in its message that most sort of white people who aren't well versed in these conversations would be inclined to see it as like a good film, both sort of in terms of the filmmaking and in terms of like its message and its values.
Yeah, I think so. For those of you who have not seen the film, first, I would not recommend this film to anyone except to say if you need something fairly inoffensive that won't make you uncomfortable to watch with your family over the holidays, you could go see this and you can just sort of quietly seethe like I did, but that is essentially what it is. And so the praise that has been heaped on this film by largely white critics blew my mind as I was sitting through it. I was prepared. I had read quite a bit about the film and about critical reactions to the film, both from white critics and from Black critics before seeing it. And I was determined to go in with an open mind. But as the minutes ticked by, and by the way, if you're counting, this is definitely an Ebony runtime rundown. I was starting to check my watch at like hour 30, and I was just like, get me out of here. But this is a film, as has been said, a film by white people for white people. And I think, you know, as you say, it is a way for, because it is a, you know, shiny example of the white savior trope in film, it is a way for white people to feel comfortable about doing nothing other than being friendly. There is this pernicious myth that systematic racism will be eradicated if we can all just get along as people, if you can just meet a gay person and see that they are human. If you can just share a beer with a Mexican person and see that they're human. If you can just talk over your fence at your neighbor who is a disabled woman, you will see that she is human. You know, this is a myth that is, it blinds us. It is seductive, but it is ultimately false. And so the film is super offensive in that way. But I also want to talk about how, again, you know, as you say, Carol, so the film is called Green Book, right? From the title alone, I was expecting Mahershala Ali to play a bigger role in the film that is ostensibly about his life and his experiences in the South. It is not about him. The film is about his driver, Tony Vallelonga. It is even, I would say, until the first third of the movie has transpired, not even so much about their friendship. It's about Tony and his family. And you know,
oh, absolutely.
So it's not even like the friendship that is supposed to form the backbone of this film doesn't even, you know, take up as much part of the film as it should. But, you know, I remember thinking, you know, before, like, it takes forever for the Green Book, the titular Green Book of the title, to actually make an appearance in the movie. And so I was thinking, like, why is this film called Green? It is not, it is entirely possible to go into this film not knowing what a Green Book is and having very little more idea about what the Negro Motorist Green Book was at the end of this film. You certainly don't learn anything about sundown towns, which form a crucial segment of the film. But then it occurred to me, and this is by no means something that has just occurred to me, I'm not a genius here, but that Tony Lip is himself the Green Book of the film, right? Like, that's why it's like he has been cast as the thing that does what the actual Green Books did for Black people, which is allow them to have safe passage through the highways and byways of America and ensure that they have, you know, fun and engaging experiences. You know, the Green Book is not the Negro Motorist Green Book, the paper example.
Right.
It is the person of Tony Vallelonga. And it blew my mind. Like, the arrogance of suggesting that what Black people need is just friendly white people. White people who encourage them to live some more authentic version of Blackness that includes Kentucky Fried Chicken and Little Rich. I was losing my shit in this movie. I wanted to burn down the theater.
Yeah, I mean, so the danger, right, of films, because, and this is not like, it's not an individual film, Green Book. Green Book is emblematic of a pattern that runs throughout, you know, cinema history of films that center white people in stories about, like, racism and in which, so the really, yes, this is not a film in which the two characters have equal importance in the story. It is a film about Don Shirley, the character played by Mahershala Ali, his function in the arc of the narrative is to provoke the growth and change to whatever degree that happens in the Viggo Mortensen character. You know, having said that, I do think that I have to praise Mahershala Ali's performance in this film. Like, he is extraordinary. I mean, what a range this actor has. You know, when I thought he was phenomenal, you know, in Moonlight, but that was one type of character. And here we see him playing an entirely different man. And like, and he inhabits the role so completely such that, I mean, the physicality of his performance, the precision and sort of delicacy, the controlled way he moves that speaks to, I think, and reveals the way that the character of Don Shirley has to control his emotions so profoundly as he travels through a world and specific parts of America in particular that explicitly hate him. I mean, just the tremendous effort of will that must require, and that, you know, to look in the face of that kind of dehumanization with, I mean, you know, with any kind of dignity. And then, you know, you have these moments, these scenes in which you actually see him on the piano, playing the piano. And I mean, there is something about the way that he moves when he is playing the piano. It, to me, it spoke to like perhaps it is only when he is there on stage at the keys of piano that he experiences some measure of freedom, in the sense that he can like express or channel his feelings into something, because you see all this emotion in his body. You know, it's a really remarkable performance, not to mention, like, I mean, he looks amazing. I mean, there, you know, early on in the film, he, you know, he's like wearing this like dark blue suit, I think, as he's like sitting in the back of the car on the road trip. And oh my God, he looks like just incredible. Oh, you know, yeah. Like, he just looks amazing.
There's so many stills from this film that look as if, excuse me, they came out of a GQ spread. Mahershala is a canvas that upon which like color and emotion finds free expression as the film progresses. And I agree with you, his performance is absolutely marvelous. And in fact, both Viggo Mortensen and Ali deserve a better film. You know, these are two phenomenal actors who deserve better writing and a better film. And I think there is a film that could have been made about this that they could have started in that would have been absolutely remarkable to watch. But one of the things that I do credit Ali with is that as the film progresses, you know, I take offense at the notion that he is allowed to live more authentically and more honestly the longer he travels with Tony. But I nevertheless responded to the way that, yes, he physically starts to uncoil as the film goes on. And so the thing that we can't even imagine him doing at the beginning of the film, which is smiling or laughing, he does with such explosive joy later in the film. There is nothing in this world like a Mahershala Ali smile. It takes over his face. You just want to fall into it, you know? And the quiet moments, too. Spoiler alert. Spoiler alert.
Soylent Green is people.
So one of the things that you probably do not know, if you've never heard of Don Shirley, you certainly wouldn't have heard about this. And I haven't read too much, like sort of casual conversation, about the film that talks about this, but it is also important that this is the story, not just of a Black man, but a Black queer man. And yes. So after, in a very, you know, moving scene, after Tony has had to, you know, sort of rescue essentially, Don Shirley from the clutches of a police force that has caught him, you know, in flagrante with a white man at a YMCA in the Deep South. After that, you know, the relationship between them, at least as far as Don Shirley is concerned, now is fraught with anxiety and tension that he had never hoped to be there. This was something about him that, you know, was private. He had never hoped to reveal, right? And he makes an assumption that Tony will take the opportunity to, you know, to leave him on the road and go off and, you know, conduct business with his mobster buddies. The way that he asks Tony to stay, that quiet moment where he is pleading, without, you know, whining or begging, but it is the smallest moment. And he makes this request in the only way that he knows how, which is to offer Tony more money and a title bump to road manager. But just the way that he carries that grief of knowing, like, please, please,
Yeah.
It was just a phenomenal. It was, I wish there had been more of that in the film.
Yeah. I wish that I believed. So, you know, because the Tony character, I mean, he's obviously he was a real person, but of course these are fictional constructs of those people to serve the needs of a sort of conventional script. So I can't know what the real Tony's attitudes or prejudices or beliefs would have been specifically at this time. But, you know, he is a man who explicitly has a lot of, I mean, he, you know, he constantly says that, like, all Germans are, I don't know, rats or something, you know, like he openly to Don Shirley, like, he expresses his attitudes of just generalizing entire groups of people. And yet then when, you know, this news, when he learns about that Don Shirley is queer, he says, you know, hey, it's a complicated world. I've been working in New York nightclubs my whole life. Hey, like, I didn't entirely believe that he would be so sort of, you know, I mean, comfortable isn't the right word, but so sort of permissive, I guess, about that while maintain, it's like he's enlightened in this one particular area, but still holding on to all these extremely backwards ideas in all these other areas. I just didn't believe it in the framework of the story, in the arc of his character, I guess, as the screenplay was presenting it.
Yeah, and I mean, even if that were actually true, again, your personal relationships, your personal individual relationships with individual people does not exempt you from, you know, horrific racism or misogyny or homophobia as expressed, you know, against the entire community. So it takes Tony Lip, you know, coming to work for this regal, dignified, almost astoundingly accomplished Black pianist for him to, you know, start to, you know, take that mental journey to believe that, oh, you know, he's a man like I am, you know, he deserves respect. Like, dude, but the amount of hoops that, you know, Black people, that people of color have to jump through, we have to be superhuman to be considered human, right? You know? And
yeah,
there's the notion that this is what it takes, that we need to perform dignity and respectability and genius for then individual people to decide to grant us their friendship and, you know, consequently their humanity is offensive to me. I'm also offended by the fact that, you know, at the end of the movie, we see, you know, that Tony and Don have made it back to New York just in time for Christmas Eve dinner. And Tony's family is having this huge family gathering. And these are people that we have, you know, seen be casually racist throughout the film about Black people, right? And yet the film chooses to have Don Shirley, you know, have an epiphany that no, he does need human connection. And the people he needs human connection with is Tony and his family. So he goes, the film ends with him, you know, making the move outside of himself, you know, taking the chance to not be lonely, to connect with someone and going over to Tony's house. And we're supposed to celebrate this. And I'm like, no, why is it always us that has to do all of the work? Why is it that he has to enter their world, but it is never about them entering our world, you know?
I mean, this film, to be clear, it was directed by Peter Farrelly, who is, of course, a white man, and he co-wrote it with Brian Hayes Curry and with Nick Vallelonga, Tony's real-life son. So all three writers on this are white men, as well as the director being a white man. And you know, like, this is not a story that should have been entirely conceived and written and directed from a white perspective. Like, that's just somewhere along the line in terms of the, you know, you have this idea for a film, hey, we can tell a story about this, like, this road trip, this friendship, whatever, you know, somewhere along the line you say, okay, but we need to get some Black involvement in this, right? Because this is not our story. This is not our story to tell entirely. And yeah, so that's a fundamental problem with it, I think. I do want to go ahead.
No, I was just going to say that, especially when the decision has been made that the story is going to be structured in the way that it is. But if you were going to suggest, as the film does, that white people need to teach black people how to culturally code switch, which is precisely what this film teaches. Like, Tony, you know, teaches Don Shirley how to navigate blackness in a way that makes absolutely no sense. And one of the, you know, critical reactions to this film that we should take note of is the reaction of Don Shirley's own family, who, you know, have taken issue with the lies of this film, such that, you know, the film suggests that, for instance, that Don Shirley was sort of completely divorced from blackness in the black community. There's a scene where Mahershala Ali, you know, says, like, if I'm not black enough for black people and if I'm not white enough for white people, you know, what am I? This is not true. Don Shirley was embraced by the black community. And yet the film chooses to pull him out of blackness. As I've suggested, there's a way in which the white audiences and, you know, the white creators needed to shape his blackness. And to do so, they had to pull him out of extant blackness, you know, in a way that just, you know, obviously it shouldn't sit well with people. But yeah, I think that if there had been, you know, black people involved in, you know, the creation of this film, they would have been able to shape it in a way that didn't suggest that.
Yeah. As Candace Frederick, so Candace Frederick wrote a story for Slash Film with the headline, Green Book somehow manages to make a uniquely black story all about the white guy and the results are ridiculous. She, in her piece, writes, you know, that, well, you know, one issue with the film, quote, is the fact that Tony's voice is the more prominent one between the two, often sharing his bad takes on black music and food, since he's supposedly a better expert on blackness than Dr. Shirley because he listens to Little Richard and eats fried chicken with his bare hands and the latter does not. It's impossible to reconcile the terrible irony that this racist white man tries to enlighten a black man about his culture using silly stereotypes as he carelessly totes around the Green Book. This is utterly ridiculous. I do want to say briefly, though, as you mentioned, like, Viggo Mortensen is also, I think, you know, both of these actors play characters who very easily could have been the stuff of caricature. You know, it's certainly Tony could have just been the broad kind of, hey, mob, tough guy character. And obviously he has those elements, but I do think Viggo Mortensen just inhabits the role again to a degree that he makes Tony a little more than that. But also, like, the way his physicality contrasts with Shirley's physicality. So Tony moves through the world just taking up as much space as possible. Like, he's just so huge in his physicality and just as if he feels entitled to exist and take up space, as much space as possible, which is what the world has kind of taught him is the case. But, and there was one moment in the film where Don Shirley says something. I forget what it was, but Tony has the completely absurd reaction of, that's a very prejudiced thing you just said to me. And it reminded me so much of Trump saying to a reporter who challenged him about, you know, something recently, Trump saying, that's a very racist question. Right. that like for a moment I could actually see, I'm like, wow, you know, with this physicality and I think with his, like, range as an actor, Viggo Mortensen could offer, like, if there were a film that were trying to really lay bare Trump's ego and his kind of evil, I think that there's a way in which Viggo Mortensen, you know, he may not be able to mimic Trump, you know, accurately necessarily, but he could provide such a psychologically believable portrayal. And I saw, you know, just that flash before my eyes in that moment. I was like, oh my God, like I really want to see, like, a very serious film that's about laying bare Trump's ego and, you know, personality with, like, maybe Viggo Mortensen in that role, because he's just so good at, like, taking up space so completely.
Yeah. In fact, you know what? When we have our John Wick podcast miniseries, mm-hmm. I would love it if we followed it up with a podcast miniseries on Viggo Mortensen and History of Violence and Eastern Promises, because I feel like those the four films speak to each other in a lot of ways. I would love to do this. Let's do it. Let's record it today.
Okay, great. I think we both have more to say about this film, so we're going to continue this conversation in the bonus. So if you're a Feminist Frequency Radio backer, you can listen to that. And now it's time for... What's Your Freak Out? Ebony, what's your freak out this week?
My freak out is I can't be trusted with a streaming service or to make media decisions on my own, Caro. So every day, we are presented with the gift of new, amazing things to watch, to play, to read, to engage with. But inevitably, I turn my back on these things and just rewatch old favorites. Right. So my freak out this week is that something I do probably, I don't know, once or twice a year is rewatch a bunch of old West Wing episodes because I used to love that show.
Sure.
I used to love it. And I, like a lot of people who, you know, watched it either when it was out or when it shortly after it ended, you know, fell into the trap of imagining that it was more liberal than it actually is.
Yes.
Right. So anyways, I've been rewatching the show and I have been just increasingly horrified by the way I fell for the Aaron Sorkin okie doke through all the years that I tried to convince other people to watch The West Wing. And one of the things that I have been increasingly confronted with is, and I wish there probably is a study on this. I bet if I looked for it, if I Googled it, it would be there. But if not, can someone go back through all 7 seasons of The West Wing and just count the number of times someone explicitly says, we're going to have a woman problem, or we have a woman problem, or we're going to have a problem with blacks? Because this happens so often in the show, and it's presented as, you know what, yeah, you know, what these people are saying is valid, whether it's about like family medical leave, whether it's about racial profiling, you know, whatever, but they're preventing us from doing actual governing by bringing up these issues. Why won't these people just let us make these decisions and stop making problems for us? And it's so horrific and insidious because the core group of people on the West Wing are people that we love. They are smart. They are passionate. They are on the side of the righteous, we are told. And so when a character that we love, a character like, you know, Josh Lyman, for instance, who is the deputy chief of staff, you know, when he expresses the opinion that, you know, we're trying to get this budget passed, but the National Organization for Women is throwing up trouble because, you know, they're not letting, you know, this amendment about lack of family, this is going to hurt us. Why do they keep doing stuff like this? We are supposed to sympathize with his position and resent the women who are making his life difficult. And this show does this constantly. And when it's not disrespecting women in this way, you will find, this is another thing I want people to count. Aaron Sorkin has never met a speech he would not write and have someone deliver, particularly his character stand-ins like Josh Lyman. But if you were to track how often someone needs the complexities of a particular legislative issue or constitutional protocol explained, and the person delivering that explanation is a smug white man delivering it to a younger woman, a subordinate woman, or a person of color, I think we would be surprised by how often that happens on the show, or perhaps not surprised at all. I have gone from rewatching this show because I loved it so much to rewatching it just to point out in every single episode how fucked up it is. So that's my freak out. Would love to talk about it with the people who I already know. I can think of the usernames who are going to be hitting me up on Twitter to argue with me about this. But that's my freak out for the week, that I was inexplicably rewatching The West Wing all weekend.
At this point, I think the only part of The West Wing that I still like to rewatch is the 5 minutes or whatever from the one season finale where the storm breaks and Dire Straits Brothers in Arms starts playing you know, and watch this,
mm-hmm.
right?
So good.
All right, so my freak out this week, I really only have one option of something to choose for my freak out this week because it's literally the only thing I've been doing in any or all of my spare time.
Singing with your church choir?
Yes, yeah. I have to talk about Red Dead Redemption 2. I don't even know what I want to say about it because I'm still playing it. And this is a game that is full of contradictions. And it's a game that I love and I hate at the same time. And it has moments of beauty and surprisingly interesting character arcs and writing and things it's doing that very much in my mind run against the grain of the typical kind of, you know, video game power fantasy, and it tries to subvert your expectations, and it does that both narratively and with some of the mechanics that it employs. You know, the world that it creates of this contrasting place of burgeoning cityscapes, you know, in the vastness of kind of American, you know, wilderness and plains and mountains and forests and such, I mean, is at times breathtaking. And it's been a long time since a game created a world that I found myself living in as completely as I feel like I have been living in the world of this game when I play it. Obviously the protagonist is a white man, and, you know, it's a story that sometimes tries to acknowledge racism, but through the, you know, the typical perspective of the white cowboy criminal American anti-hero, and that can be very troubling at times. And yet it's also trying to do things with Arthur that make him not the typical, you know, that kind of, again, as I said, try to sort of challenge what we expect from such a figure. I'm extremely conflicted about it. The only way that I know how to deal with a situation like this is to finish a game and then take some time to sort out my thoughts and feelings and write about them in some form. So that is my intention. For all of its problems, and they are numerous and they are very real, it is a work that is worth engaging with. I will say that. So, like I said, I have no other options because it's all I've been doing in my spare time. So I can't, like, it's not so much, this is not like a yay, this is amazing freak out, or a boo, this is terrible freak out. This is the only thing I've been doing, and I have all kinds of feelings about it freak out. And stay tuned for more when I actually have some idea what I actually think of this game.
I am excited to read your Red Dead Redemption 2 theses that you nailed to the church door when
yeah.
you finally get it written down.
Yeah. All right, you can submit your own freak out, and it might make it on the show. Just head over to feministfrequency.com/freakout. That's FREQOUT. That is our show. You can catch us back here every single Wednesday. Stay tuned for the bonus episode, which is only available to backers of this podcast, which you can be. Just head over to d.rip/femfreak. If you're enjoying the show, please rate and review us on iTunes, and tell your friends when you're driving them through the Deep South and forcing them to eat Kentucky Fried Chicken. You can check out all of our work and our other podcasts at feministfrequency.com. So be sure to follow us on Twitter @FemFreak to stay up to date on all the news. You can find our fearless leader, Anita, on Twitter @AnitaSarkeesian. You can find me @CarolynMichelle.
You can find me @DonShirley'sThrone.
Oh, man, what a throne. Our producer is Phil Circus, who also composed our theme music, technical support by Sarah Norales, production assistance by Taylor Simmons, and art by Jamie Varon. We'll see you next week.
Bye.